From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. You know that saying? It's all about how you see things. Today on our program, we talk about perspectives, because even a positive attitude can't always save you from how others view you.
I can get dressed up in what I think are my best clothes, and I found myself in situations where people confuse me for the help in whatever business I go to.
And what about having more than one point of view on an issue that you care about deeply?
So as a woman of color, if you had any loyalties to your culture, which means that, no, actually, I really want Chicano men to be free, to care even, you know, meant that you were less of a feminist.
We explore perspective through three conversations. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA. But have you ever checked out our friends at Alt Latino? Their show is a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music. It features sounds like psychedelic tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. Hear from the Latino artists changing and challenging the established order every week on Alt Latino from NPR Music at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Juan Felipe Herrera's official occupation is poet. But it took him a long time to call himself a writer. To him, poetry is a way to look at the world from multiple perspectives.
The word writer really is kind of an individual term. I kind of came into being in a collective fashion.
Juan Felipe's work tells the stories of his roots, of the Mexican farm workers he grew up with in California. But he also writes from the perspective of the children of Darfur or of a girl living in war-torn Gaza. This love of language comes from his childhood. When Herrera was growing up in the 1950s, his mother taught him songs from the Mexican Revolution. To pass the time in the fields, the two solved riddles and played word games.
Mixto, nixtamal, tamales, you know, it could just go on. And it could have rhythms in it, you know, nixta, nixta, tamal, tamal, tamales, mesa, mesa, chocolate, mesa, café, café del barrio, café con leche.
In his early 20s, Juan Felipe made this playful use of language political. He mixed Spanish and English together, becoming a prominent poet of the Chicano movement. Just listen to the way he weaves in and out of both languages in this poem.
Let us gather in a flourishing way, contentos, llenos de fuerza tu vida, giving nacimientos to fragrant rios, dulces, frescos, verdes, turquoise strong.
Coming of age in 1970 San Francisco, Juan Felipe found himself inspired by the beat poets and by punk. This poem is called Punk Half Panther, an ode to the rough street culture of his California youth.
Poetry mad and Chicano style and done wild, rumble boy, rumble girl, and wonder and amazement. On the loose, cruising shark-colored maze of presidential bombast, death-enshrined archipelago fashion malls, neutered wars across the globe.
Today at 67, Juan Felipe Herrera is the first Mexican-American, the first Latino, the first Chicano to be named Poet Laureate of the United States by the Library of Congress. So we thought, who better to start us off on an episode all about perspective? Now, despite that fancy title, Juan Felipe hasn't shied away from his radical politics. At his inauguration ceremony, he performed a corrido for Sandra Bland, an African-American woman who died while in police custody in 2015. The corrido is performed by musician Juan Diaz and translated by Juan Felipe.
Estuvo presa tres días, no supo lo que pasó. Con una bolsa de nylon dicen que sola se ahorcó.
She was in jail for 3 days. No one knew what happened to her. With a plastic bag, they say she committed suicide.
You have this pretty amazing experience as an American poet in that you're, you know, part of the experimental poetry movement, part of the Chicano movement. You're clearly political. You're an activist, you know, and then you get this call from a very buttoned up mainstream institution called the Library of Congress. Did you ever think that, you know, these two worlds would come together, the Library of Congress and your very radical American Chicano life?
No, you know, I never thought of that. And also, I'm not much of a forecaster. You know, I'm always writing or walking around looking at leaves fall or having conversations or getting excited about a painting. That's really the world I'm at. Farmworker family, we always lived definitely from moment to moment. So that's how I am. And all of a sudden, like, right, you're right, I entered this other planet that was part of this planet, but I had never thought about being in it.
Especially this sense that you are being recognized for your voice, for your very particular voice, for your writer's voice, for your speaking voice. And I think about the fact that actually when you were in first grade, you were silenced. Tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, I only spoke Spanish growing up in the fields with my mother and my father. And they spoke some English, but, you know, we spoke puro español all the time. But going to first grade, I had to guess where to go. My father just pointed at the building and he said, that's your school and that's it. And his army truck, his campesino army truck from the 40s. So I walked out of the truck and I ambled towards this building, not knowing really what it was. It was a school, but I didn't really know what a school was, an elementary school. Found a door and I just opened it and there was a group of students huddled in the corner and a teacher. I must have asked something in Spanish and I was late because we, you know, we didn't know there was a time to go to school. I didn't know what that was either. So I got spanked for being late and I got spanked for speaking in Spanish. And, you know, my parents were very kind. From going from that kind of soft, earthy, sun-scorched, traveling in a trailer world to a room in a formal school and being spanked. It's like being shocked with electricity. But I had to work through it. You know, I had to find a way.
So you walk into school in first grade and you're terrified, get spanked for speaking up, because you were speaking in Spanish. But then something happens, and I think your mom had something to do with, again, preparing you for what happened when you were in third grade, which is when your teacher, Mrs. Sampson, actually says, you, Juan Felipe, come to the front of the class and speak.
That's right. She called on me. She says, John, you know, can you come up to the front and sing a song? And she was such a great teacher that I didn't feel threatened or pressured or surprised or shocked, even though it was an impossible mountain to climb. And I just walked up there. And then I sang Three Blind Mice. Three blind mice, three blind mice. And then I just kept on and I finished it. And I was just, you know, finished with it. And then she turned to me and goes, my, you sure have a beautiful voice. And that was my life-changing moment. And by the end of the year, I sang a solo in front of the whole school as a member of our class choir. That's what she was able to accomplish with me that year. And it was the compass for the rest of my life, working with my voice, becoming visible, and also becoming someone that would invite others to express their beautiful voices and tell them that as well.
It's not everyone who, once they find their voice, immediately understand that they want to be a writer, much less understand that they want to be a poet. What was it about your experience, you know, your entire kind of experience as a young person that said, y voy a ser poeta, and I'm going to be a poet, and not only a poet, I'm going to be a fully bilingual poet who has no fear in mixing up English, Spanish, and creating Spanglish?
Well, of course. That's right. There's no fear in art. Once you put fear in art, you're not going to create art. It will be very difficult. And remember, when we talk about the social movement for positive change and social change in the 60s, late 60s, in the Chicano movement, of course, in the student movement, I found all my brothers and sisters that I never had. And we were all kind of saying the same thing. And that's where I became what we call a writer and a poet. But I didn't call myself a writer or a poet because I was part of a community. And we were all working together. And my contribution was poetry and performance and theater and speaking. Now, but then again, I was knitted. I was tejido. I was knitted to everyone.
Why the political? For you, the political symbolizes what? I mean, it's not about party or even, you know, voting or electoral politics. For you, it's politics in life and in art. Means what?
It means love, you know. It means ending the suffering of others. You know, it means providing a plate of food for someone who is starving. It means stretching out your hand at the edge of the road and pulling someone up who's just on their back because they're just fried from those miles and miles and miles of crossing that border and making it to southern Arizona desert. So that's the feeling. That's the depth of where I write from and where I move from. I grew up in that world. My mother always cared for others, and my father worked very, very, very hard up until the 70s in those grape fields. Imagine that. I couldn't do it for 10 minutes in the scorching heat in Fresno, California, when the summertime comes and grape season arrives. And yet my father did it until the 70s. So I want to assist those that are living that life as best as I can.
From migrants working the fields to Black Lives Matter protests in the streets, Juan Felipe's work connects people's struggles. Here he uses the traditional Spanish ballad Corrido to talk about the death of Sandra Bland.
Voy a cantar un corrido de una mujer que murió. Sandra Bland se llamaba, dicen que se suicidó.
I'm going to sing a ballad about a woman who died. Her name was Sandra Bland. They say she committed suicide.
El día 10 de julio en Texas, ¿qué sucedió? Por no señalar la vuelta a la cárcel la llevó.
It was the 10th of July in Texas. The police arrested her.
Coming up on Latino USA.
But what I feel, you know, is that I'm suddenly, I look at young people and those ideas that we had as young radical women of color, you know, are actually more needed now than ever.
A conversation with another Chicano icon, writer Sheree Moraga. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA. Do me a favor, rate and review our show on iTunes because it really does help. And meanwhile, I want to say a big, big thank you from all of us at Latino USA to all of you that donated to keep us on the air. Every single donation, every single one makes a real difference for us. And you know what? We love to read the comments. So Christine from California wrote to tell us, Latino USA makes her feel connected to her people, her culture, and her soul. Wow. Thanks, Christine. So if you want to join Christine and so many others, send us a contribution by going to Latino USA and click on the donate button. Every penny helps. Muchas gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today it's all about perspectives. So what's the perspective on feminism? In some media, 2015 was called the Year of Women. And if you look at popular culture, feminist ideas and paradigms are being factored into mainstream media all the time, brought up in politics, in comedy, and in sports. Feminist conversations are happening, not behind closed doors, but publicly, on social media like Twitter and Facebook, and in every crevice of the internet. And so much of that critical online conversation now is being led by women of color. As we move forward, it's also important that we look back. In the 1980s, Sheri Moraga was at the center of the conversation about the perspectives of feminists of color. Sheri Moraga is a Chicana writer, activist, and now an artist in residence at Stanford University. Sheri got a lot of attention for the book This Bridge Called My Back, a seminal anthology featuring the writing of many radical women of color, each exploring their own version of feminism. Moraga edited the book along with her longtime friend and collaborator, Gloria Anzaldúa, and it was published in 1981 to rave reviews. Anzaldúa died in 2004, but I spoke with Sheri Moraga last year after This Bridge Called My Back was re-released by SUNY Press. And since today we're focusing on perspectives, we started our interview by going back to when I first met Sheri Moraga, back when I was just starting out as a young journalist. I remember very clearly when I interviewed you.
Mm-hmm.
I was a kid journalist. I was still in school. I mean, I was just in awe. You were this trailblazer. You were a Chicana out lesbian feminist, third world political revolutionary.
I'm scared now.
Yeah, man. And that's how I walked in.
Uh-huh. You said I was angry, though, right?
You know what? Actually, angry, mm-hmm. that word.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of that word and you think about when This Bridge Called My Back mm. first came out, would it be wrong to say that you were an angry Chicana third world feminist? Were you angry or was I wrong?
Oh, I was terribly angry. And I don't think it's a was.
You're still...
Of course I am. You know, I think I'm angrier. You know, Bridge came out in 1981. I was, 28 years old, something like that. So, you know, so I see it in my students is that, you know, that 20-something... You know, when conciencia hits you, you just realize that, you know, everything you had learned wasn't true. I mean, what you learned in books and, you know, and beginning to make all of those kinds of critical connections out of a lived experience, not out of books. It's just, you're just mad, you know?
I mean, for me, and I think for so many women, so many feminists, you were the rebel. You were the one who was saying, you need to look at this. White feminists, you need to look at this now. I wonder about particular moments or stories where you've understood anger as part of your rebel self.
I mean, when I went to graduate school, it was like one example is I walked in, I wanted to study feminism because I thought, oh, I'm really interested in the liberation of women. I'm interested in the liberation of women, not out of some white notion of it. I was interested in it because I grew up in a home that was incredibly The relationship between men and women and the freedom that men had was so distinct from my own life experience. I wanted to be my brother, you know, and not just because I'm a lesbian. I wanted to be my brother because I looked that he was free, that anything he wanted to do, he could do if he wanted to do it, you know. And so I can go into the stories about my wrong repression at home. But what happens is that when I go into the world, then white women are describing a kind of freedom that had nothing to do with our lives.
So how would you remember hearing white women talking about that freedom?
Well, one of the main things I remember, my criticism, was that there was a movement called lesbian separatism at that time. So what they said is that basically, in order for you to really be an authentic lesbian, you had to not have any relationships with men at all. And then we're just talking about sexual relationships. They're talking about every aspect of your life, which is virtually impossible. But still, there was a kind of whole movement.
Smash the patriarchy, right?
It was smash the patriarchy, but like at an impossible level, because what it really meant, when it really came down to it, it meant that also then you had to give up your father, you had to give up your brother, you had to give up your son for some of these women. And so as a woman of color, if you had any loyalties to your culture, if you insisted on having loyalties to your culture, which means that, no, actually, I really want, you know, Chicano men to be free. You know, actually, no, I would like our boys, you know, to be able to have a feminist understanding culturally that's specific to them as Mexican boys. You know, I would like, you know, any to care even meant that you were less of a feminist, you know. So that caused an incredible rift in the movement. And basically, I'm grateful for it because you're talking about being pissed off. It pissed off many of us enough that we decided that, in fact, no. What feminism is, there's Chicana feminism, there's black feminism, there's white feminism, there's women of color feminism. And that was so much the motivation for Bridge, which is to basically that we had the right to define how our people wanted to be free. You know, so when we say our people, then it's men and women, you know, and the harder work then of trying to deal with the sexism of the men of our own cultura, you know, that's harder work than separating. That's a daily, daily, daily lived work. But what I feel, you know, is that I look at young people and those ideas that we had as young radical women of color, you know, are actually more needed now than ever.
So what would be those ideas as young radical women of color that we need now?
I think a fundamental idea that, you know, the kind of feminism that we talked about was not trickle-down feminism, like the belief that if we get enough women in the Senate or whatever. It's just oftentimes, I mean, not that that is not a legitimate way, you know, to create change in the world, but it's not fundamental change. And the idea of women of color feminism, the Combahee River Collective said, if black women were free, everyone else would have to be free. And I would say, I would add that or change that to say, if indigenous women were free, all people have to be free. So what you're looking at really is you're talking about what does it mean, you know, if you like, I'm just thinking about the Occupy movement, right? And you see these young people, and they were mostly middle-class kids doing the Occupy movement for the most part, you know, and I live in Oakland, I went and I attended and I looked at it, and I'm thinking, what's missing in this picture? And most of the time is what's missing in the picture is really the direct involvement in activism by women of color. Now, the Black Lives Matter movement is happening now. If you look at black women, leadership is fierce there. I mean, it is completely integrated. The leadership is coming from those black women. And partly a woman of color consciousness is you're looking at it and you're saying, wait a minute, how does that movement change when white, you know, so-called white radicals are running these movements as opposed to those initial women of color? Because when the women of color are moving, these are oftentimes working class women, they're going to make sure everything's taken care of. They're going to make sure that the needs, you know, the poor are taken care of. They're going to make sure that, you know, feminism is an issue. They're going to make sure that anytime any kind of radical movement happens on a certain level, it has to be attended by those that are on the bottom.
So in your view right now, what is the movement that captures these radical women of color setting the agenda, pushing forward? Is it the immigrant rights movement or is it something?
Well, I see it among raza, you know, and in the Southwest in particular. And also what's interesting, also queer men and women. Right. So the UndocuQueer movement has gained an incredible momentum because the youth has gained momentum. Much of the spearheading has come from student youth movement. So I look at that, and I'm kind of watching how this is happening. I'm thinking, oh, my God, this really is the personalist political, because what those undocumented youth are saying is that, no, 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 I don't get to be out just one way. If I'm going to be out of the closet as an undocumented person and I'm going to put my life on the line that way, then I'm going to be out the other way. I'm going to say that I am queer if I am queer. And so what that moment does in history is it's saying our intimate life is equally as important as any kind of material struggle that we have. So without women really involved and queer people really involved in these kinds of movements, we're the only ones that speak up for that intimacy. We're the only ones that say, wait a minute, what's happening in your bedroom that's hurting you? You know, or what's happening in your bedroom that you deserve to protect? Or what's happening across the kitchen table? Where do those bruises come from? What about rape on campus? So the people that we have to trust in order to sort of create a strategy for any kind of liberation have to come from the people that are experiencing it. That's what theory in the flesh is. We don't need to, you know, look beyond that. The question is always is strategies, you know?
So would you say that when you look at some of these movements like the UndocuQueer movement, you know, the most disenfranchised, right, undocumented and queer are actually pushing a political agenda? You're seeing student movements. So does that make you feel optimistic?
Yes. Or? Oh, definitely. But, you know, I just really feel like even when you look at this is just to be real about it. When you look at that UndocuQueer movement, right away, what you see, I say, well, that's a really great radical movement. And right away, what you see is that what's happening then in sort of Congress, right, is to then make sure the Dreamers are taken care of. That's even considered radical for the Dreamers. And all the Dreamers are saying, wait a minute, what about our families, man? They're the college educated ones, right? So if anybody got a shot, it's going to be them. They're saying, but wait a minute, don't forget our families. Their parents are the ones with the four jobs, not them. They're the ones that need liberation. They're the ones that need support. They're the ones that need the right to live here. We're not even talking liberation. We're talking about the right to work. All it is, it's so regular. It's such a basic thing that every human being can have where you keep walking through and you're saying, what's wrong with this picture? Who's missing in this picture?
So, I wonder how you feel about what's happening in terms of the feminist space now. You know, and a lot of people immediately point to the feminist conversation online that generated by hashtags and social media. Do you think about working class women? Are you saying to yourself, look, they're not online. They're not, they may be using their phones for one reason or another, but they're not, they're in fact not connected. Does that worry you?
Well, I guess I have always believed that, I mean, I'm a writer and you're a writer and you're a journalist. It's like, so we must believe that on some level that there is some relationship to these kinds of exchanges of ideas. Even someone, you know, hearing this radio show, when you're talking about people not having access to, you know, all the mass media stuff, no, but their kids do. It's a multi-pronged approach. So partly there's nothing wrong with the hashtags and everything else. I mean, I very begrudgingly began to use them. And the truth of the matter is it has gotten information out that I want to reach people so quickly. And I don't know then what those people that get that information, who are they interacting with? Sometimes it's as simple as, and this happens with my students, you know, I'll see this young chick kind of come to me and she says, but I have all these ideas. She'll say, what do I do with my mom? You know, is my mom está sufriendo? She doesn't have these, you know, she's getting, you know, whatever, you know, her husband's horrible to her, or that she's tiene una vida muy triste, you know, like that. She goes, I just want to save. They want to save their parents, you know, their grandparents, everything. And I say, I don't want you to use one word of feminism when you go home. I want you to think it. I want you to feel it. I want you to know it in your body. And I want you to just be present for your mother.
So not a word of feminism.
In other words, when you start talking that language, right, it's like it sounds like a foreign tongue, right? And so partly what we need to do, and that's where class comes in, because the struggle is that, you know, we go to, you know, so I was this way with, you know, first generation college. We go to college, we learn language. You come home, they say, oh, you're talking like, you know, you're, yo sé todo.
¿Quién te crees?
Sí, sí, exactly, you know. So what I was talking about is the function of coming home and listening. And so I think what young people feel sometimes that they have to go and, you know, have their fists raised and do it like with all of the jargon, you know. But when we go home, we can't do it that way. We have to see who they are, and with our own loving manner and our feminism in our bloodstream, almost figure out what they need.
So I'm going to tell you this moment, because I remember when I was taking my first women's studies class at Barnard. Mm. And my mom was working at Mujeres Latinas en Acción. She was working with domestic violence and getting women to safe places, to own their power. Mm-hmm. And I called up my mom after reading, I'm sure, some of your work and other, you know, iconic feminist work. And I said, Ma, eres feminista. You're a feminist. And she said, No, mijita. No me llames eso. I don't burn my bra. I don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I remember just saying, Mom, feminism means helping another woman to own her power.
Right.
And then she was like, okay, soy feminista.
Sí.
And now she's, you know, probably still 79, calls herself feminist. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting notion to not come home and start lecturing your family, but listen a little bit more.
Well, I think it's one face of it. You know, I also think there's the real need for grassroots strategic organizing. I mean, when people are doing, you know, protests, or they're actually trying to do, like in Arizona when they were banning books, you know, and people began the, you know, the
Libro Traficante.
Eso. And it's like that, you know, like concrete actions that raise consciousness that actually can affect policy. If you create, you know, the whole idea about protests is that if you agitate enough, it makes the powers that be uncomfortable enough that, in fact, there may be some relationship to eventual policy changes, right? But that takes a long time, and that takes consistent work. I mean, the best model of that was the civil rights movement. It created policy changes. But, and you look at that period of politically what was happening there, it is worse now, though. It is more Republican, more white right-wing now than it was even then. So our task is, you know, all the greater, right? So I'm not saying that we just go talk to mom at home and everything's cool, that we do need also if we have, particularly if we feel like we have skills in that way, or we have desire in that way, or we just have the voice to shout on a corner, you know, whatever it is. You have to recognize also what your gifts are. What is courageous for one person may be simple for somebody else. Sometimes the people have said to me, oh, you know, you're so courageous. Da, da, da. And honestly, I'm not trying to like, oh, no, no, no. What I mean is that I knew I was loved. I knew I was loved. And that's a foundational thing that I feel like there was most times I could do things in my life. And like my mother said it to me, there's nothing you could do, honey, that, you know, mijita, that you would not be my daughter. And that's what she said to me when I came out to her, which was the scariest time in my life, to say to my mother that I'm a lesbian. And for her to say that to me, I said, I'm free. Somebody else comes to their mother and they tell, they come out, no big deal, right? But for me at that time was the most courageous thing I could have done. And I had no choice because I knew I would be dead if I didn't come out. But the point of it was, when somebody then meets you and says, there's nothing you could do that you would never be my daughter, you're free. In other words, you're loved. So that love gives you a foundation to feel like you're a valuable person and you're willing to take risks in your life. So from my vantage point now, I watch how people take risks in their life politically, what they can say, the ones that can stand on the street corner, the ones that can get themselves arrested, whatever it is. You're the only one who can say what courage is for you, you know? And so my feeling is always just push it a little more than you're comfortable with. If you're comfortable, something's wrong. If you're uncomfortable, then you're probably in the right place.
Chicana feminist, activist, and writer Sheree Moraga, sharing her perspectives with us. And coming up on Latino USA.
So when we were really young, we had no money, and I didn't realize it till I was older. My mom would use comedy to make us not notice that we didn't have things.
Comedian Cristela Alonso with her thoughts. Stay with us, no te vayas. Hey, thanks for listening to Latino USA, but have you ever checked out our friends at Alt Latino? Their show is a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music. It features sounds like psychedelic tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. Hear from the Latino artists changing and challenging the established order every week on Alt Latino from NPR Music at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Los ruidos de tu boca, en vez de molestar, me desprenden la ropa, deprisa para amar. Hay algo diferente, tan sobrenatural, que nos lleva al comienzo, después de terminar. Tú me amas y se queda conmigo, prometido, como el vino en la copa, y este amor encendido, que nunca camino había tenido contigo. No hay principio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from American Jewish World Service, working for 30 years to end poverty and advance human rights worldwide. Learn more at ajws.org. And the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And now, a perspective about Latinos in primetime. Comedian Cristela Alonso starred in the short-lived ABC sitcom Cristela. It was the first ever U.S. primetime sitcom created by and starring a Latina. I sat down with Cristela just as the show was getting all sorts of attention, but after just one season, ABC canceled the show. Cristela, the comedian, responded to that news in a long post on her blog. She wrote that she was frustrated, that people wanted the Latino Huxtables, but that that wasn't her truth. Now, these days, while you can't see Cristela on ABC anymore, you can see it on Netflix. The entire first season started streaming online last November, which has brought the show a whole new audience, with some even tweeting at Netflix trying to get the company to take on the show as its own. So we decided to revisit my interview with Cristela about the experience of trying to bring her perspective to primetime network television. Cristela Alonso, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And I've always admired stand-up comics because I just think it takes a big pair of ovaries, in your case, to stand up and tell jokes. What made you do that?
You know, growing up, I come from a family. We lived well below the poverty line. We were very poor. Grew up in a border town, South Texas, San Juan, Texas. You know, my mom came here from Mexico, and her whole life was about survival, getting by, and she always told us not to dream because she didn't want us disappointed. So when we were really young, we had no money, and I didn't realize it till I was older. My mom would use comedy to make us not notice that we didn't have things. So it was her way of entertaining us and keeping us happy.
So what would that look like?
She would make jokes about, you know, old things that we had and how new, you know, people loved new things, but we were so different that we liked old things, you know. It was cool to like old things, you know. When I was a kid, we would go to the grocery store, and for years, and I mean years, till I was about 8 or 9, we'd walk down the cereal aisle, and my mom always said that the boxes were empty. And I wasn't allowed to touch the boxes. And then she would go down the aisle to the big bags of cereal, the ones that, you know, like the 3-pound bags of cereal.
Those you could touch.
Yes. And she's like, that's the cereal that should go inside those boxes. Those boxes describe the cereal that's available at the end of the aisle, you know? And it's funny because
I love your mom. Yeah, she was like seriously thinking on her toes.
She was. She was amazing, you know? She was amazing. And, you know, I think that from her, I got my sense of humor. She was very sarcastic. It was funny. She had a second grade education. And it's funny because people think that when you hear that someone has a second grade education, I think a lot of people don't assume that they're smart because they don't have the education that people are used to. She was a brilliant woman, though. I mean, she was innovative. The fact that she could make do with so little and make things happen showed how smart she was. I always loved comedy because of that. I learned to do comedy when things got difficult. I ended up having to move to Dallas, Texas, to help my sister take care of her kids and my mom. My mom got sick. My mom told me when I was 8 or 9 that I was going to be the one responsible for her when she got older. And it was always understood that that was going to be my job. So I had to stop everything that I was doing. I was trying to perform. I was trying to build my career. I had to drop everything and move back home. So when I moved back home, my family thought that I was done trying to chase after this dream, and now it was time for reality. Well, my mom got sick, and I took care of her. She passed away a year after I moved to Dallas. And I found myself so depressed because now I wasn't chasing any dream that I wanted. I'd lost my mom. I didn't know what to do. And my family, not having money, I couldn't afford therapy. I couldn't afford to go to a doctor and see if there was anything to make me feel better. So I used stand-up. So I started doing stand-up to talk about my mom. And it was really therapeutic. And I never set out to do stand-up about my family, to try to get this TV show. And it was never about that. It really was a means of surviving. So I started telling these stories about my mom, and I found that everybody got my mom. Everybody knew somebody like her, even if it wasn't their mom, their aunt, somebody that they worked with. The personality was familiar, regardless of regardless of being Mexican or not, being Latino or not, the stories were similar. So I started talking more about my family because that's all I knew about. So I started talking more about my sister, my brothers, my nephew, my niece, and more people got into it because they could all relate to these family stories.
When you see other successful comics and you think about the big personalities and you're like, well, now I'm going to get on stage and try to compete with them.
I've always lived off of this idea that, because we grew up poor, I've always been kind of fearless to do things because I had nothing to lose. What was the worst that could happen? I know that anything I try to do with my life, regardless of whether I fail or succeed, I will never be as hungry as I was as a kid. I will never do without things that I did as a kid. Sure, it'll hurt, but the disappointment goes away. Knowing that I tried to do it, that was the best feeling I knew I could ever feel in my life, because the last thing I wanted to do is have regret.
So now you get to have a television show and you get to go on to put, for example, this great scene where you go in for the job interview.
Yes.
With this character, and it turns ugly pretty fast.
Yes.
Oh, can I toss this in before you empty that?
Is this really happening?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, I am so sorry. Obviously, you're not the cleaning crew. Can you validate me?
I think you've been validated enough.
Is that liberating to basically just be like, I'm going to tell you what it really is like?
Yes. And
in modern day America, if you're Latino.
I love that you say that, because when we got the show picked up, I started doing all these interviews, and I saw that a couple people here and there would ask me, why would you think that anybody would ever confuse you for a cleaning lady? Why would you think this?
Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And they always said the same thing. But you were dressed up. Why would anybody confuse you for the cleaning lady if you're dressed up and you look like you belong? That's what they said. And my response was always, well, it's happened to me. I'm writing it out of truth. It's not that I'm trying to create this agenda. I don't know what you think, but I can tell you what I deal with. I can get dressed up in what I think are my best clothes, and I found myself in situations where people confuse me for the help in whatever business I go to. Now, that doesn't make me feel good because I'm wearing the best things I own. Those moments have made me feel bad, and I wanted to show that in the show because I wanted to show that that is something that we deal with. The way that I react is the way I react in life, though. I laugh it off. I laugh it off because I always feel like the moment you laugh at someone, you take away their power, because now you're trying to show them that what they said didn't affect you. and that makes them mad.
You do have this smile on during the entire show.
Yes.
You've got this little smile, and I'm like, how does Cristela do that?
The biggest note I got for the show was to just be myself. And I just, that's who I am. And I think that's what you can tell, hopefully, from the show, is that you know that what I am in the show is really exactly kind of what I am in real life. Everything I say, I defend to the ends of the earth, because what I talk about is true to me. I don't try to assume. I don't make assumptions about anybody. Anything that I talk about has been based on my experience. And I always tell people, as long as you personalize the experience and personalize your journey, no one can argue with that, because it's your life.
Now, have people said to you, oh, my God, you're the next George Lopez?
You know, I'm fine with it, because I know what they mean. They're trying to say that they think I have a shot, but they only refer to certain people that they can grasp to. I did a screening a couple days ago, and this woman after the screening, I did a Q&A, and she said, hey, the mom in your show, that's not my mom. My mom wasn't like that. My mom was a sweet woman who cared for me, went on and on. And I said, that's great. My mom wasn't like that.
Your mom was an angry Latina.
Right. My mom was this woman. I can't write your mom. Like, you know, your mom sounds amazing. I didn't have that mom, you know. But and then she said, why is it that every time Mexicans get shows, they always have to have the same mom? That, so you mean George Lopez and me? By every Mexican, you mean both of them.
That's it, right?
You know, it's like all of us, all hundreds and thousands. Mexicans just get shows
every
week.
So many TV shows.
Right now. Yeah.
So many Mexican moms talked, that you can refer to.
I know. Yes. You know, the time we've talked, 1,000 Mexicans have gotten married.
Have been on prime time.
Exactly. And, I told her, I'm like, well, we're both Mexican, and I can't speak for him, but maybe we had the same character. Maybe we had the same mom. I think he was raised by his grandmother. Maybe they were similar characters. But I did tell her, like, see, you're focusing on the older woman. My sister's a mom too. In the show, she's a mother. So it's like you're going after the older woman, the oldest woman in the show. Why aren't you saying anything about the sister character? Because her mothering is completely different from my mom's way of mothering.
So when you were growing up, mm-hmm. In South Texas, did you feel confused about, am I Mexican? Am I American? Am I Texan? Am I Latina? Were you confused about your identity
definitely.
At all?
Definitely. You know, I
thought you were going to be definitely not.
No,
but definitely,
of course,
yes.
Because I mean, I grew up in the 80s in Texas. Everybody I knew was Mexican. We spoke Spanish a lot. My grandmother lived in Reynosa, Tamaulipas, so we used to go visit her every Monday, which is my mom's day off from work. My life was really it was heavily involving like the Mexican culture, you know. But then when I'd watch TV, everything was American. My mom was strict. We had a lot of gangs in the neighborhood. We had, she wouldn't let us hang out with friends. We were always supposed to go to school, come home, and that's it. We weren't allowed to go out. Because of that, TV became my friend. So TV was the only connection I had to the American life, my version of the American life.
So, Cristela, what does that mean to you when you think about the fact that other Latinos are going to be looking at your show and saying, that's me? Have you thought about that?
That was actually one of my goals with this show. I've always thought about it. You know, it's funny. People always ask me if I'm excited about this show coming out. And I always say no, because I'm too busy working to really accept what's happening. But for me, I always think of my mom. I think my mom is a very typical person's the story of a typical person that's never told. My mom came here from Mexico because in her village, they had no electricity, no water, no anything. Life was really primitive and very rough. And she came here not realizing that by coming here, she was doing such an amazing, heroic thing. You know, she never thought that what she was doing was special. And it blows my mind that she never knew that, because I thought that what she did was so amazing. And I want people to know the stories of families that come from that kind of person. They did so much for us. And they're never appreciated or recognized.
Are you serious? We're going to cry? You've got tears in your eyes, Manita.
I do. Well, because to me, it's just, I really want to tell the story of people like me so that people like me could be inspired and know that they have a shot. I think it's really important to me. I think that's the most important thing about this show for me.
I can't believe it. We're supposed to be laughing and we're crying. Gisela, you, it's that heart that's going to change everything. So thank you so much for for your laughter, for your tears, and for that heart.
Thank you so much.
And good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Comedian Cristela Alonso. You can stream her show, Cristela, on Netflix. We're going to end our show with some sabiduría, or words of wisdom, from Sheree Moraga, who we heard from earlier. Moraga has been an artist in residence at Stanford University for almost 2 decades, but she tells us that even in the face of a major institution like Stanford, it's always important to stay true to who you are.
I'm in this department, an artist in residence, which is different than being a professor. They kind of let me do whatever I want to do. And it's kind of good, leave me alone. But there's prejudice. I think there's a lot of ignorance around who Chicanos or Latinos are. And it has not been necessarily a comfortable place to be. At one point when I had just been there 5 years, I came in for a reappointment conversation with the then chair, and the chair had said to me that they were very pleased with my teaching, but they were somewhat dismayed that my people, as he put it, were not taking other classes except my own, meaning Latinos, right? And then my heart starts pounding because I realize what he's asking me to do is to be kind of proactively integrating the department, right? What I learned through feminism is that I'm not going to spend my life trying to get white people right. That's not my work. Racism is their problem. So I think, oh, my God, he's asked me to integrate the department. And, you know, I'm thinking about the mortgage, the first mortgage I ever had. And so I go and I say to him, those students, those Latinos do not come to those other classes because those classes do not respond to them in any way culturally. They feel like they're going into foreign land. I said the way acting is taught, the way literature, you know, drama is taught, everything is Eurocentric. You know, I told him, I said, I can't help it that those classes do not respond to those students. That is the problem of those classes, and it's not my problem. But I'm not saying this easy, man. My heart is going out of my throat. I'm going to lose the job for sure. And I said, I can't do it. I just couldn't go back to that, you know. So I go home, and I tell my partner, Celia, I said, okay, I'm one man. Pack your bags, man, because the job is over. And I was completely convinced that the job was over, and it wasn't. They hired me, and they've hired me 15 years after. But what it taught me is that I was free, that I was never going to be so wedded to Stanford that I couldn't walk out if I had to. If we're saying anything to any of your young listeners or whatever, how do you continue to live a life where you feel like you can be yourself and walk away from what's not working?
You've just got to walk away from what's not working. And I hope you can find the courage to walk away from what's not working in your own life. But meanwhile, we'll keep on working for you. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Fernanda Echavarri, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Julia Hsu is our production assistant. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant, and Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
Who knows? I think I don't know what I'm doing, to tell you the truth.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org. And Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA.
It definitely helped. Those first 6 months were definitely the most crucial because it definitely helped with keeping myself emotionally stable to where I wouldn't lose it, basically.
Mental health and pediatrics, the push to help children and families. Next time on Latino USA.